Next case is Brown versus the people, and the petitioner may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I'm Rebecca Frey-Ray, number 20010. I'm a Deputy State Public Defender, and I appear today on behalf of Micah Brown, who is the petitioner. The issues presented for review today deal with whether there is a factual basis in the record to support the requested lesser offense of attempted second-degree murder and the intoxication instruction the defendant was charged with and convicted of attempted first-degree murder. And I want to get right to that because I believe, as I think it's apparent from the brief, that there is sufficient evidence in the record. And I think there's well-established law that if there is slight evidence, no matter how improbable or unreasonable, and there's a rational basis for acquittal of the greater and conviction of the lesser, then the defendant is entitled to a lesser instruction. And it's the same whether it's a lesser included or a lesser not included. This just happened to be a lesser included.
May I interrupt one second?
Sure.
Just because you can get me on the right track early on.
Yes.
I may have missed this, but do we have case law from us where we have extended that principle from homicides to attempted homicides?
Not specifically, but I think that has been in, that's been the basis from the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's been present throughout all of our case law that if there's slight evidence in the record and there's a rational basis, then you can get the instruction.
But we've made the distinction, haven't we, between homicides and other crimes up to this point. That is, the slight evidence we've only applied in the homicide context. Is that not right?
I don't believe so, but I know that is true in the homicide cases. And I believe I don't think that there is a huge distinction with attempted homicide or any kind of justification. I mean, I think in the Rivera case, which was an old case, this court said there is no reason not to instruct on a lesser offense that happened to be a lesser non.
But Rivera doesn't have the language, any evidence, however slight, right?
No,
it says
no.
A rational basis to acquit of the greater conviction.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And the statute, you know, the lesser included offense law comes from the statute. And the statute allows a court to instruct a jury when there is a rational basis in the evidence to support the conviction of the lesser and acquittal of the greater. And I think that there is, in this case, that rational basis. I know that the people are arguing that the defendant's claim of innocence precludes a finding of a rational basis, but I think that is inconsistent with a lot of case law out there, both in the U.S. Supreme Court and in Colorado, where you can have inconsistent defenses. You can get an instruction when you're claiming self-defense on a lesser-included offense. And so I don't think that, I think you have to look at the defendant's testimony because you have to look at all of the evidence in the record, but it's a focus on what the evidence is in the record as opposed to what the defendant's theory is, because it's just that. It's a theory. The jury's instructed. It can reject that theory. It can accept part, all, or none of it. A defendant's testimony is considered the same as any other witness. And in this particular case, there are two facts that provide the evidence, the basis for acquitting of the greater and convicting of the lesser. And the first was cited by the Court of Appeals in its opinion, and that was the defendant's action of taking the gun, holding it to the victim's head, and then making that decision to move it away from the victim's head and fire the gun. We have all seen cases where defendants don't make that decision and they fire into a victim's head and kill them. And there is no, in that kind of a factual scenario, there is no argument, there is no rational basis for a lesser included offense of second degree murder or anything less than that. But when someone takes the action of actually moving the gun away from the head, and then coupled with the fact that in this case the victim was alive when the defendant left the apartment, I think you have to view this under what this court, the standard articulated by this court of Mata Medina, you have to look at this in the light most favorable to the defendant. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals didn't do, is to look at this evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant. And those two facts together, I think, provide the necessary evidence to warrant the instruction. Now, there's a lot of other facts I cited in my brief, which are circumstances surrounding that, other things that were going on. The victim said he was acting, he was angry, he was quickly moving about the apartment. There were live rounds in the apartment that were not put back in the gun and used. So there were things, there were circumstances surrounding the shooting that would support, when you view it in the light most favorable to the defendant, the lesser instruction. And I think, and then added to all of this is that the jury sent out a question about reasonable doubt. They requested clarification of the reasonable doubt standard. And so if you look at what the cases say about the rationale for lesser offenses, the rationale is you don't want a jury to be thinking, oh, this person committed a crime, but we really don't think that he or she committed the greater crime, but that's all we have here, so we're going to convict of the greater because we don't have the lesser. That doesn't ensure accuracy in the verdicts.
Can I ask you a question? Quite apart from the quantum of evidence problem, rational basis to acquit of the greater, convict the lesser, quite apart from that, is there any separate authority in our case law for depriving somebody of a lesser offense instruction if they have actually testified and in effect or expressly said something, admitted something which is completely inconsistent with them having committed the crime at all?
Well, in Colorado, there's the Garcia case, which is out of this court, and treated the defendant, and that's kind of strange. There's a statement that the defendant makes to the police where he denies any involvement and says the intruder did this. Then there's a second statement where he says, yes, I was involved. And then there's his trial testimony where he says, oh, my first statement was the true one. It's the second one that wasn't true. And this court treated that as a judicial admission. But I think that is inconsistent with what the jury is instructed, that they should treat the defendant's testimony as any other witness, and they're free to reject all part or none of it.
So you think we should overrule that case, or?
Well, it was a lesser non-case. I don't know that it really fits this case, but yes, I do. I think that was wrongly decided as far as the judicial admission doctrine is concerned. I don't see how a defendant's testimony can be considered a judicial admission that somehow precludes other arguments. The jury is the fact finder, and treating it as a judicial admission then takes that function away from the jury and doesn't allow them to decide, well, maybe that second statement made the most sense because he admitted involvement.
Which is the lesser included offense, or two of them that you're trying to
actually, no.
Advocate?
I know that defense counsel argued below for a reckless manslaughter as well as attempted second-degree murder. I did not raise attempted reckless manslaughter in my opening brief in the Court of Appeals because I couldn't see a rational basis for making that argument. There wasn't any evidence in the record of reckless conduct. So I am only asserting that the attempt second-degree murder instruction is what should have been given.
You have to help me out, though, because then after he turns the gun aside, he shoots her three times.
That's right. And
so,
I mean,
how does that pass the straight face test
for
that lesser included offense?
Sure. Because he makes the conscious decision not to shoot her in the head. But that shows, I think, that it wasn't his conscious objective to kill her. He shoots her three times in the abdomen, meaning he's aware of what he's doing. He's not firing those three shots into her head. He is aware that he is practically certain to cause her death by firing three shots into her abdomen. There's no question about that. But I think the fact that he leaves her alive in the apartment and that he didn't shoot her in the head shows that it wasn't his conscious objective to kill her. I think you could make the rational argument of that. If you're the jury and you're sitting there looking at this, I could see the jury back there saying, well, gosh, he moved the gun away from her head. This isn't attempted first-degree murder, because if he wanted to kill her, he would have just left it there. So I'm not saying that it's necessarily a winnable argument, But I think it is one that should be able to be made. I don't know that defense counsel would have actually argued it, but it's something, there are facts in the record that the jury should be able to consider in making a decision about what happened and should be able to give full effect to the reasonable doubt standard and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Turning to the intoxication, that's a little different standard. Intoxication defenses or instructions are treated more akin to theory of the case instruction. If there is some evidence in the record to support the instruction, then a defendant is entitled to it. In this case, there was background information provided in the state's evidence. The victim testified that my client testified he was drinking beer at the time she got home, that he had had an ecstasy pill. She testifies that she comes home, that he has said he's taken an ecstasy pill, that she gets in the shower, that she takes an ecstasy pill. She looks in her bag and she decides, well, he had to have taken a second one because there's only one left in my bag and there were four there to begin with. She testifies that she was high on ecstasy for 3 hours and that she took the shower and her ecstasy pill around 10:30 at night. They then leave and go to this bar. She says she's high for 3 hours on ecstasy. You can be high up to 4 hours. There's nothing in the record about how long he was high. But if he's had two ecstasy pills, then we go to the bar and he has two drinks. He has two Crown Royals. There's nothing in the record about how these two mix, unlike Miller, where the methamphetamine was counteracted by the alcohol. There's just none of that testimony about the effects of these two substances together. He testifies that he leaves the bar, that he was too high to play pool, so that the women played pool, and that's what they testified to, that they were the ones that did that. He takes the bottle of vodka before she leaves the bar. He says he starts drinking that bottle of vodka in the cab. There's evidence in the record that he arrives at the Motel 6 at 1:30 in the morning. From the motel people, he testifies that he is drunk at that point because he's been drinking this liquor in the cab, that he goes to his room and he continues to drink this bottle of vodka. So we don't know how long beyond 1:30 he's drinking, but he makes a couple of phone calls. He calls a friend. He calls his brother. His brother says, "You're too drunk to talk to." He says they hang up. He continues to drink. He gets sick. He passes out. We know that sometime after 1:30 in the morning. And we know that, and then he testifies that he wakes up at 9, that he's got a bloody nose, that he has blood on his shirt. And we know when he's arrested in Iowa, they take his clothing, they take his shirt, they find blood on it, and it's male blood. And they don't do any further testing because it's male blood. It's not female blood. I think that's enough for the jury to consider an intoxication instruction. A jury is told you rely on your observations and experiences in life in reaching decisions. And if jurors have ever been intoxicated, they know what it feels like to wake up after drinking that much, after passing out, after getting sick. I think, and then the record also showed that she still had ecstasy in her system, in her toxicology. So it was still in her system many hours after the crime.
Well, what time about was the crime?
I think it was about 7:30 in the morning.
7:30 in the morning?
Yeah. So there were probably, you know, I would say anywhere from 5 hours, you know, probably about 5 hours, assuming he can. I mean, the thing is, we don't know in the record how long he continued to drink or when he had these phone calls. We know he checked in at 1:30. That's all we know.
I'm confused about the relevance of the motel. Where did this shooting take place? I thought it was at her apartment, right?
The shooting took place at her apartment, but he presented testimony through the motel workers that he, in fact, checked into that hotel under a false name, and he was arrested with that false ID, which showed the time that he checked into that motel and showed that he had checked in under that name previously as well. So that was his testimony, but it was corroborated by the motel people who came in with records to establish when, in fact, he checked in. So I think looking at that evidence, I think that the intoxication instruction should have been given, and that the jury should have been able to consider.
I'm sorry, Ms. Ferrier. What, yes. What time did his evidence show that he checked in?
1:30.
At 1:30.
1:30, yeah.
1:30 a.m.
1:30 a.m. Yes, and I think the crime happened at about 7:30 a.m.
So the theory, the defense theory at this point is that he left the motel and went back to her apartment.
That's the prosecution's theory, that he left the motel and went to the apartment and murdered her, or attempted to murder her. And yes.
Maybe I misunderstood this, but I thought I read somewhere that supposedly this required him to climb up 3 stories on the outside of the building.
Yeah.
Because he came in through the balcony.
That's what the victim testified to. There really wasn't any evidence presented by the prosecution as to how that could have occurred. But if he was in a blackout state and didn't remember what was going on, maybe that could happen.
Your time is up. Would you like to just wrap up on that?
Yes, just would ask this court to find, to reverse Mr. Brown's convictions, finding that he was entitled to these instructions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Chris Bosk, attorney registration number 39036, representing the people. If I may, I'd like to offer the court a brief roadmap of the people's argument before I begin. I think there are two bases on which this court can affirm the Court of Appeals ruling that the defendant was not entitled to the instructions that he requested, the lesser included of attempted second degree murder and the voluntary intoxication instruction. The first basis is by finding that a defendant can't rely on a scenario that he has under oath declared to be false in order to obtain an instruction. And the second scenario is by agreeing with the Court of Appeals that there was absolutely no evidence in the record to support the giving of either of these instructions. And if I may, I'd like to start with the first basis. We should not allow a system in which a defendant is permitted to testify that his alibi defense is the truth, and in the same breath, ask the jury to lessen his culpability based on a finding that that testimony was a lie. And I think this court has already expressed that position in the case People v. Garcia. In People v. Garcia, quoting language from an Oklahoma Court of Appeals case called Spuler v. People, I think that's how you pronounce that, this court noted that where a defendant takes the stand and testifies in such a way as to render every theory of defense unavailable save one, he will be deemed to have elected that defense. The facts in Garcia were that the defendant had an alibi defense. He said, you have the wrong guy. He testified that a story he gave the police that might support another instruction was not true, and he nevertheless asked the court to give the jury that instruction. This court said, Garcia can't claim that an intruder stabbed the victim and at the same time obtain an instruction based on the theory that he stabbed during the heat of passion. I think
Mr. Bosch,
please.
I guess I'd like you to address with respect to that matter, that principle. One, the idea of the ability to present inconsistent defenses, and the other, the idea dealing with what happens when the defendant himself doesn't testify.
In other words?
Well, the evidence can probably more likely than not goes along with the prosecution theory, but
right.
At the same time, there's some evidence of a defense.
I see what you're saying. Thank you, Your Honor. I think the important distinction and what Garcia was trying to tell us is that, okay, we recognize a general rule that you get an instruction if there's some evidence to support it, but there are going to be exceptions to that rule, or at least there's one. And the one exception is when the defendant himself testifies that he has an alibi defense, that you've got the wrong person. There's, by force of logic, he's telling the jury that another set of facts that might support another instruction is not the truth. And I think that I'm not sure if waivers,
principles, presumption, and all that.
You know, I think
you don't want to treat him like you would treat any other witness. I mean, that's the problem.
You know, I think that, I mean, my feeling is that we do in almost all cases, but in the specific case in Garcia that Garcia presented, where a person takes the stand and renders every theory of defense unavailable save one, he's sort of removing this evidence weighing function. He's telling the jury, I'm completely innocent. You've got the wrong person. Everything that people are saying is untrue. He can't turn around and in the same breath ask them to lower his culpability based on a finding that he was lying.
I guess I want to ask why. I mean, what I'm trying to ask is, what is the underlying principle or rationale for this policy?
You know, the best way that I can phrase it is that we shouldn't encourage a defendant to perjure himself in the hopes that he can have it both ways and just see what the jury's going to decide.
So the idea is that it's sort of punitive, even at the risk that this lying defendant may be convicted of something more than what he's guilty of, we will punish the liar.
Well, I think
is that the idea?
You know, I think there's some weighing of concerns to be done here, clearly. The concern we're presenting is whether we want to condone what we know to be something that is not true because the defendant has told us as much. You know, there are obviously competing concerns.
But wait a minute, it's not condoning what we know not to be true, because oddly it presents in the other circumstance, right? I mean, it presents in the circumstance of it's the defendant's testimony saying that this is untrue that's actually rejected.
If I understand your question, Your Honor, I think that I would disagree, because where a person testifies that he's absolutely innocent, what he's saying by force of logic is that a theory of the facts that would support an inconsistent instruction is necessarily not true. So I think that he is telling us that
that's what the defendant is saying, but it presents in a situation where the defendant is convicted. The determination is sort of the opposite. And so we're in the process, really, of having not allowed the consideration of the lesser as punishment, essentially,
right,
for what turns out to be, according to the jury, testimony that's not credible.
In other words, couldn't the jury disbelieve the alibi but find that the state failed to meet their burden?
That's the situation, right? I mean, the trial situation is always going to be the prosecution's asking the jury to disbelieve the alibi. And so the prosecution's theory of the case, and if there's a conviction, the circumstance determined to be true by the jury, is inconsistent with the alibi. It's inconsistent with whatever a defendant explains. It's the defendant's testimony that's rejected, and therefore, as a punitive matter, we also reject the possibility that he might be guilty of a lesser instead.
Well, I guess the question then is, should he have the opportunity for the jury to consider the lesser where he's already told the jury that the facts supporting it are not true?
That's the idea. It's sort of forfeiture.
I think it is. I think in the limited situation that this court addressed in Garcia, there is a kind of forfeiture. And I'm not here arguing at this point doesn't seem to go beyond Garcia, but Garcia, I think, explains a rather simple and narrow exception to that general rule.
Is there any other authority out there supporting this other than Garcia in the case that you mentioned that it relies on?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I think the one thing I want to just get across to the court before I move on to the purely factual question is that I think the Court of Appeals in Brown just went too far. I think the Court of Appeals didn't see that this exception laid out in Garcia would apply to the facts in Brown. And the court went beyond Garcia by saying, well, an absolute innocence defense is not going to is not a bar to an inconsistent instruction. And I think that this court in Garcia has already told us that this isn't always the case, that there's a general rule, there's an exception, and it's my position, it's people's position, that the facts in Brown should have been controlled by Garcia. If there are no further questions, if there are no further questions on that first issue, I'd like to move on to the purely factual question. The Court of Appeals was correct in finding that there was no evidence to support either instruction, a lesser included of attempted second degree murder and a voluntary intoxication instruction. With respect to the attempted second degree murder instruction, no rational jury under these facts could have found that the defendant acted with anything other than a premeditated intent to cause death. The facts, and I think I agree more or less with defense counsel in terms of the statement of the facts, but I'll go over them once again. there was an argument at the bar. The defendant leveled a sort of vague threat towards the victim, telling her, if you take these keys, it's the last time you'll take them from me. Hours later, he did, in fact, scale the side of her apartment building to enter her apartment by way of the sliding glass door. How he managed to do that, I can't say, and it's not in the record, but he did it. Once inside, he leveled a clear threat toward the victim, saying, so you thought you'd be safe here by yourself, and he destroyed her cell phone. Then he followed her into her bedroom and pointed the gun at her chest at close range and unloaded 3 hollow point bullets into her body and ran away, leaving her at death's door. To say that he acted with anything other than deliberation and an intent to cause death, this is odds with reason, and it finds no support in the record. With respect to this issue of the defendant pointing the gun at the victim's head and then moving it to the side before firing what we might describe a warning shot, I'm not really even sure what that was, but that act only tells us that it wasn't his intent to kill her with respect to that shot. It says nothing about what his intent was a few seconds later when he pointed the gun at her body and unloaded 3 rounds into her. I think, again, we can't transpose any meaning from that first act into the second. It was clearly his intent to kill her when he shot her 3 times at close range with hollow point bullets. And if there are no questions about that issue, I'd move on to the second.
You said that was clearly his intent, but the question here is, was it premeditated, right? Is that the same thing as saying that it was his intent?
Oh, no, I would agree with what I think you're saying, and that's that there are 2 different issues. I think the facts that I just discussed leave no room for doubt that this was a premeditated act. In fact, there was nothing introduced in the record that would at all support of anything less.
I understand you're saying there was no evidence at all, but can I ask if you have a position with regard to the question whether our standard in homicide cases, which is any evidence no matter how slight, should apply to an attempt homicide as well?
The right answer, the correct answer for me to give you right now is that I do not know, and I shouldn't speak to that at this point. I do know that in all the research I did with respect to this case, I didn't see a case, state or federal, that appeared to draw a distinction between those two. But I can't say for sure that one doesn't exist.
Yes, just the follow-up on that. So you're asking us to draw a line between intent and premeditation and knowledge such that there's not any evidence, no matter how slight, that a reasonable jury could find that he only acted with an awareness that he was certain to kill her by doing what he was doing, rather than that he premeditated to kill her.
If I may, are you asking me if there's a burden of proof of showing both those?
Well, what I'm asking is, by you saying that there is no entitlement to a lesser offense instruction here, it seems to me is what you're saying, there is no evidence from which a reasonable jury could find that instead of that he didn't premeditate, he only killed her with the certainty that he was going to be killing her, because that's the difference between second degree and first degree, isn't it?
Our argument is that there's no evidence to support that he acted with anything less than intent, and there's no evidence to support that his acts were anything less than premeditated.
So merely the circumstances in which he killed her, assuming everything she says is true, even those circumstances would not allow a reasonable jury to decide that he only acted knowingly.
I don't think the facts present any basis for that, Your Honor. With respect to the voluntary intoxication instruction, the only evidence that would support a finding that he was intoxicated on the morning of the shooting was his own testimony. His own testimony was that he returned to the hotel, drank a bottle of liquor, and passed out sometime around, we're not really sure, but we know it was around 1:30 or 2 before the shooting, and woke up the next morning after the shooting of the victim. He testified that he remembered passing out, and on cross-examination, his attorney asked him, well, are you sure you never left the hotel, correct? He answered, correct. So as per his own testimony, any evidence that would support the giving of a voluntary intoxication instruction is rendered impossible by his own testimony. He was at the hotel the whole time drunk. He couldn't have been voluntarily intoxicated at the victim's apartment. I think there's absolutely no basis for the instruction.
Unless you rely on some policy like Garcia, why isn't a jury free to pick and choose what parts of his testimony they find credible and what parts that they don't? I mean, can't the jury believe some of what he said and not all of it?
I think where the defendant, where his sole defense is one of alibi, I don't think that he should be entitled to have a jury consider an instruction on a theory that jurors may take bits and pieces of his evidence and bits and pieces of the people's evidence and find him guilty of the lesser, which is not positively supported by the evidence at all. In other words,
but isn't it your argument, is it really based on what the evidence supports? Because certainly, unless you have a Garcia policy against it, a jury could disbelieve his testimony that he never went there, but believe all his testimony preceding that in terms of how intoxicated he got.
You know, I suppose that they could, but I think that that Garcia explained that there's an important policy against that thing, and I would, against that type of situation, and I would.
So this is not strictly an evaluation of the evidence. It is instead, once again, a reliance upon a policy that imposes some punishment for testimony that's not truthful.
I think it's both. And I see that I'm out of time, so I thank the court.
I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.